Good afternoon, everyone. This is Tom Hayden. I'm substituting for Ian Masters, and I'm here today with his producer, Spencer Downing, and Alan Minsky. We've got a very busy 1 hour ahead because I've just returned from Sweden and have a report and a discussion that will follow about the Swedish perspective on the WikiLeaks case involving Julian Assange. We're also looking for Barbara Lee, who we comes and goes. So I think we're going to begin.
Well, before that, this is Spencer Downing. I produce Background Briefing. Thanks a lot, Tom. I appreciate you being here. Thanks for filling in for Ian, who is on a well-deserved break. And can you give us a sense, first of all, we were planning on having Barbara Lee on any minute, and she's going to be talking to with us about the situation in Afghanistan. Do you think you could give our listeners a sense of why this is so important to you to have her on and why this issue is so important?
Well, there's a relationship between Afghanistan and WikiLeaks. That is, it seems to me until WikiLeaks, there was a tremendous monopoly that the Pentagon had in what they call the information war, the war of perception. They're continually promoting their view, but WikiLeaks deflated that. And I think that helped a surge of anti-war sentiment in this country. And in the leadership of consolidating that sentiment, it was Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who's on the phone with us now. Congresswoman, are you there?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine. This is Tom. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good. You must be at an undisclosed location.
I'm in a car.
Uh-oh. Well, let me just briefly say something about your role in the anti-war movement and then leave it to you to give us a perspective of what's ahead. Barbara Lee was the first member of Congress and only member of Congress to oppose the initial authorization for the Iraq war by President Bush when everybody went along. She's a person of courage, fortitude, backed by a very strong Berkeley-Oakland congressional district, up there the 9th congressional district. And she has not let the issue slip from Iraq to Afghanistan. And it's interesting. She began on the margin as one of the few, then one of the 50, and then gradually entered the mainstream. This year, she authored a resolution before the Democratic National Committee calling for a rapid withdrawal from Afghanistan, urging the president on at a more rapid pace. And instead of being rejected, suddenly, the Democratic Party's highest body embraced that position. And from there, with the work of anti-war networks around the country, 205 members of Congress came to call for a resolution by Congressman McGovern, which called for a more rapid withdrawal than that contemplated by President Obama. So Barbara Lee has been there from the beginning and has pushed the issue of ending the war in Afghanistan front and center into American politics when many people thought it was impossible. Barbara Lee, we thank you for that and want to know what's next. What's the perspective? How can President Obama's political calculus be changed so that the withdrawal continues until all those troops are out of Afghanistan?
Thank you, Tom. This is going to have to continue to be a drumbeat from the outside. It's got to be people who understand that this war in Afghanistan cannot be won militarily. It's got to be people who really believe that, like the majority of American people believe now, that we have to do this differently in terms of revving up our diplomatic efforts, our efforts to seek a political solution, political reconciliation, looking at how we address nuclear disarmament. There are many, many issues we have to address, but bottom line is we know and most know that this cannot be won militarily. And so what the public has to do is join with us in helping. And I want to thank you, Tom, and thank everyone who's listening, because we never would have gotten these votes had it not been for the people's voice and public opinion. And so this week, for example, we have the Defense Appropriations Bill coming up. I'm going to offer an amendment that says no more combat funding for Afghanistan. We're going to only fund the safe and orderly withdrawal of our troops and our contractors. I hope people will weigh in and tell the Speaker and their members of Congress to support this resolution. It's our the power of the purse strings is in the Congress's hand, and we have to begin to use that power that the Constitution gave us as it relates to funding. Also, I'm going to offer an amendment to the Defense Appropriations Bill that would take that slush fund. There's a $5 billion slush fund. It's a war slush fund is what I call it. It's just sitting there at the Pentagon. I want to use that for deficit reduction rather than going into housing and food stamps and Medicare. And so we have an amendment to direct that $5 billion war slush fund into deficit reduction. Also, audit. The Pentagon should be accountable. The Pentagon has not had an audit. So Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky and myself are working on an amendment to audit the Pentagon, and that needs to be done. We shouldn't spend one more dime without that agency that has over $700 billion without the cost of the war to spend. And so this is really about our national security. It's about a strong national security, but it's also about reinvesting these tax dollars and our hard-earned resources into creating jobs at home, as the Democratic National Committee said when we passed my resolution. It's in the resolution that we should have a sizable and significant reduction in forces beginning in July and use those resources to create jobs at home. And that's where our priorities must and should be.
Great. Let me ask you a couple of questions. How did you strategize to bring around a majority of the Democratic Party and some Republicans for this resolution? Where did you draw the line? What kind of balance did you consider on that side of the line be going too far, but you wanted it to be a position that was ahead of the current administration policy? What goes into that?
Here, I would have preferred to have said, let's draw down the 30,000 as quickly as possible, which is the third, the number of surge, and then keep going from there. But, of course, they were not going to do that with the numbers. But I think, and we've talked to many military experts who believe that minimally we could draw down the 30,000 plus another 20,000. As quickly as possible. I would have preferred that. But again, this is a balancing act. This is the process of negotiation. And so even with some Democrats, they weren't willing to put a number in there. I was, and in fact, that's what I'm calling for, 50,000. But we were able to use the language significant and sizable, and also in terms of the funding cut for the combat mission, we're definitely going to set aside $15 billion to protect the troops and the place we bring them home in an orderly way. But we have to negotiate this language, and so that's the language for the amendment for this week. So this is very, the public, again, I have to say that people have been way ahead of members of Congress. And so I think that what's very important and what's crucial now is that the public let their members know that what has been proposed by the administration is absolutely not acceptable, and that they need to figure out a way to redirect Afghanistan's strategy now and find a way to begin to bring our troops home in a more significant and sizable fashion.
Just one other question before we move along. I noticed in the reaction of the left to the president's announcement was that it was just token. They thought he said it was only 5 or 10,000, when in fact it was 30,000 through next September. And then I looked at the speech more closely, and after he said 30,000, he said, "And a steady withdrawal will continue after that." So, isn't it possible that you could go from 30 to 50 with the right strategy over the time period of the coming election?
We absolutely could, but the point is, 30 should begin. We should begin with 50 now. We can't do this overnight, and so it's unacceptable to go to 10,000 now and then 23,000 or whatever the number was later. We need to start with 50,000 and begin to develop a timeline for bringing them home right now. Not that they're going to come home, not that we right, can get right. them home tomorrow, but that's what we need to be doing, not waiting until next year and then begin to see how we begin the withdrawal.
Well, let's be clear, though. He's committed to 33,000 by next September and right. more at a steady pace after that. So
we don't know, but Tom, we don't know what more at a steady pace means.
Correct.
And the 33,000 just takes us back to square one, which is the surge numbers. We December 2009.
Correct.
So that takes us back to where we started.
Correct, but 30,000 is not the top number. It's the first number. He's promised to get all combat troops out by 2014, which means he's got 70,000 to go as of next September. He's going to be sitting in the middle of an election. Don't you think you can push him to go faster?
Well, we're trying. That's absolutely what I'm saying. We have to make it more significant and sizable and more swiftly. And so that is what is going to be our job, both as members of Congress and then our anti-war movement, our peace groups, our labor organizations. Tom, this has got to be a movement. We need to have some street heat. We need some rallies. We need to recognize this is about peace and justice. And so, yes, we have to have it more rapidly, but it's not going to happen unless we have the push from the outside.
The president also announced that next May he's hosting in Chicago, of all places, a NATO summit followed by a G8 summit, the rich powers of the world. What do you suppose that's about? And should the anti-war movement, the peace and justice movement, the environmental movement be there to keep the pressure on as the world's elite gather in Chicago?
Sure. Well, I would hope we would help shape that agenda. You know, I would hope that whatever the agenda is going to be for the G8 and for NATO, that we're right there with the progressive community discussing this with the National Security Agency and with the White House about what some of the items should be on that agenda, Tom. And then, of course, we need to have, you know, people looking at this, monitoring it, being out there, lifting our voices, rallying. But I think we have an opportunity. I mean, President Obama, you know, understands this. He gets it. And so the left has got to weigh in a, I think, more pronounced way, like the right always weighs in. The president needs that counterbalance, I believe, as he goes into these meetings. And that's our job. We have to provide that for him. Otherwise, he will only get that input from the right.
How important do you think the peace vote is to Obama's reelection?
Well, it's very important. The peace vote, people of color, the African-American community, It's extremely important. That coalition has got to be there. The progressive vote, the environmental community. I mean, that's what put that coalition of conscience. That was the new voters, young voters. I mean, this was a huge victory that the president won. It was huge for the country. It was huge. And so we've got to keep that coalition together. And I hope that the progressive community, the peace community, recognizes that they have to vote and organize and mobilize, regardless of whether we get everything that we think we should get from a president. I mean, my God, this is about making sure that we have a marker and we fight from the inside to get what we think the best public policies are for our country. It's not about sitting home and not voting.
Thank you, Barbara Lee.
Okay, thank
Be
you.
Be safe.
Good talking with you. Bye-bye.
And this is Spencer Downing, producer for Background Briefing. We've got guest host Tom Hayden here, who's just been talking with Congresswoman Barbara Lee. And as you pointed out, Barbara Lee was the only person to vote against the authorization of force after 9/11, 2001.
That's
in
right.
other words, she was against the Afghan war from the very beginning, and she's been working hard to make sure that troops get drawn down.
Yeah, you don't see that consistency very often.
And
it's a decade she's worked on this.
And you've noticed yourself that there's been this change in strategy over time, and that little by little, the Democratic Party and, in fact, some Republicans are coming around to wanting to draw down the troops in Afghanistan.
Well, in the book by Woodward called Obama's War, that reveals the inside talks about the strategy in 2009, Obama says several times, I can't lose the whole Democratic Party. They might give me 2 years. I need an exit strategy. And what's eerie is he seems to be alone except for Biden. Hillary Clinton's not quite there. The generals are not there. It's a weird place in these meetings. But here we are on the way. We'll see how it goes. And now...
Well, I have one quick question to ask you. You know about being outside a big meeting in Chicago pressing for the end of a war.
I do.
What would you say in answer to your own question?
I'd say, Rahm Emanuel, get ready. get the permits before some of the other groups do. I would say what Barbara Lee said that really struck me was shape the agenda. She says that because she's confident from her experience that we actually can shape the agenda, not just protest it. The point is, there will be people coming from Canada, from Europe, environmental groups, peace groups, labor groups, and it's important, it seems to me, to start now. This is one of those potential protests where you get it done on the way to the event itself by putting pressure on your governments at home, including this one, to make this not a false facade of Barack Obama presiding over the free world, but an announcement that the troops are going to leave Afghanistan at an accelerated pace. Something's going to be done about global warming. Something's going to be done about jobs. It's an opportunity to draft a progressive agenda and try at local levels around the world to prevail with it. And many countries are ahead of us. There's many leaders within those countries. So I think it's an opportunity for great organizing.
I couldn't agree more. And boy, this is actually the first I heard of this, of being in Chicago. And of course, they've been putting these meetings up in, you know, some remote location in the Canadian Rockies.
No, this is right downtown. Right,
it changed with Toronto, though, where they had them in Toronto. And there were, you know, mass arrests, people who just sort of showed up peacefully were arrested. But I couldn't concur more. It's an opportunity for a lot of advance organizing. And I will be on the next conference call with the Pacifica managers to make sure we have national coverage.
That's Alan Minsky, by the way.
Interim Program Director Alan Minsky. And I'm Spencer Downing, producer of Background Briefing, with Tom Hayden, who's sitting in as guest host today in place of Ian Masters, who's taking a well-deserved break. Speaking of which, we're going to take a short station break, and we'll be back after a moment.
KPFK is heard on K254AH, Isla Vista, and K229BO, Rancho Bernardo.
Welcome back. This is Tom Hayden. I'm honored to substitute for Ian Masters, who's off on a well-deserved vacation, according to Spencer Downing, who's joining me with Alan Minsky. I have just been over a week in Sweden investigating the WikiLeaks case, and I'll be on my way to London for the appellate hearing on July 12th and 13th. In the case of Julian Assange. And I'm going to take the opportunity to brief you, the audience, for a few minutes, and then we'll go back to Q&A and roundtable discussion. The reason I'm interested in WikiLeaks, I looked the other day, I'd written 22 blogs and articles about this case because I saw it as the emergence of a post-Seattle phenomenon of young hackers and radicals and anarchists who were seizing control of the means of producing information, so to speak, and they were giving the Pentagon and the world's diplomats a really hard time at liberating information from the clutches of secrecy, secrecy that has only grown since the end of the Cold War. And I began to think of this as a fight between an open source society and a secret state, just to oversimplify it. And I took a great interest for that reason. But also, the reaction of some in our government was wildly over the top. I was really afraid for the lives of the people like Julian Assange and others, because you had members of Congress who should know better calling for his assassination, treason trials, suspension of the Constitution, hunt him down like bin Laden. That's what Sarah Palin said. So I started to get involved. And also my oldest friend, who just recently passed away, Leonard Weinglass, an attorney in New York, I was very close to him as he took on research about the issue of extradition. And he shared with me in phone calls his observations about the law and the dangers. And that led me to this story, which is being published in The Nation Online tomorrow. There was a beginning of the story on June 22nd in The Nation. You can go to tomhayden.com or to The Nation. But let me just begin briefly by saying that as I got into this story in the past month, there suddenly came a change of lawyers in the Assange case. He sits in London facing extradition to Sweden, where he faces a case involving charges of sexual assault by two Swedish women. He's fighting extradition to Sweden. And it had become a nasty fight against Sweden. And then suddenly, while I was in Sweden, the lawyers changed. He has a new attorney, a solicitor, they would call it, Gareth Pearce, who I know of and other listeners may know of from her work on Northern Ireland cases and on CIA rendition cases from Europe to places like Egypt. And she's quite a lawyer, quite a expert on civil liberties and human rights. And I took a greater interest because I thought this was going to get very interesting. The problem with breaking it down is you have to follow several streams at once. One is Bradley Manning. Private Bradley Manning sits facing a life term in Fort Leavenworth, where he's accused of downloading hundreds of thousands of documents while he was listening to Lady Gaga, by the way. And the pressure on him is to turn evidence, if he has any, against Assange and others. So far, that hasn't happened. But the State Department spokesperson, P.J. Crowley, was so upset about our treatment of Manning that he went on a rage and said it was unprofessional, immoral, wrong, counterproductive, and he lost his job at the State Department just over that outburst over the Pentagon's treatment of Manning. So that's one issue. Two is the case of the federal grand jury convened by the Obama administration that sits in Alexandria, Virginia right now and is poring over possible evidence for an indictment of Assange on conspiracy to steal classified documents. And maybe an unindicted co-conspirator would be Manning or somebody in the hacking community in Boston or around the MIT, unclear. But if and when the American grand jury issues an indictment of Assange, which I have to stress may never happen, but could also happen at any time, then they would have to proceed to seek his extradition back to the United States to face these charges. As my friend, my late friend Len Weinglass said, what the Pentagon wants, the Justice Department wants, is a photo of Julian Assange in handcuffs being taken off a plane in New York and facing trial. So that could happen. That's the end game. It could also be prevented by public opinion and by good lawyering, good political movements. The third stream is the case in Sweden. Last August, Assange was invited to Sweden to give a talk, one of the people inviting him was a woman named Anna Arden, who is a press attaché for the Christian Social Democrats who were sponsoring the forum. She was so overwhelmed with the flood of foreign correspondents coming in that she asked a contact of mine, an associate of mine named Donald Bostrom, who is an investigative journalist, to take on the flood of journalists. He agreed to do so, and the event proceeded. The result in a two-day period or three-day period was that Assange found himself accused of sleeping with Anna Arden and unwanted, in American terminology, would be unwanted sexual activity took place, not only with her, but with another woman named Sophia Willen, who was unknown to Anna. The two cases of the two women became extremely complicated in a scenario where consensual sex turned into controversial encounters and a complaint to the police. The police complaint constituted what in Sweden would be called rape or sexual assault. It went out on the wires, which was prohibited by Swedish custom and regulations, but it became a global news story swirling around the world. Then a Swedish prosecutor the next day dropped the rape charge, then reinstituted another one. Then another lawyer was able to reinstitute the charges. The end result was that Assange was facing these sex charges in Sweden, and there was a whole eruption in the blogosphere that made it appear that somehow this was a CIA or FBI plot, that Sweden was in league with the United States to defame his character and derail the issue of WikiLeaks and replace it with some kind of sexual harassment case. Those are the charges he faces, and he's opposing extradition to Sweden to face those charges. He can't really argue, if I get to Sweden, I'm going to be taken by the CIA, although one of his previous lawyers pretty much said that he would be snatched if he went to face those charges. What I found in Sweden, and I wasn't looking for anything in particular, just feedback, was that his lawyers have antagonized much of Swedish public opinion by the idea that he's not safe in Sweden, but he's safe in London, and by disparaging remarks that his lawyers or Assange have made about the women's case. I also found that most people overwhelmingly thought that because of the extradition law between European states, he would eventually be extradited to Sweden to face the sex charges. And he's only being investigated. He hasn't been indicted. He could be let loose. He could be sentenced to up to 4 years, anything in between. Most people thought it would be on the lesser end of punishment rather than the greater if the case ever came to trial. Then, and only then, could the U.S. demand his extradition. And that would give you the following scenario, my friends, and I'll just leave it here. Three countries would be the stage for protests: America, Sweden, and in Britain, because for Assange to ever be extradited back in manacles to the United States, it would require a request from the U.S., approval by Sweden after a process, and approval by the U.K. because it would be a new charge, not the sex charge, but a conspiracy charge. And, of course, there would be protests by Americans. And that could be, I don't even know the phrase for it, Spencer, Alan, trial of the century is too modest a description because this is about the hottest case in the world if it escalates to that. I want to emphasize it may not come to that. Obama may think better than trying to resuscitate Assange as a world figure by dragging him in manacles to America. But there's people in our government who want Assange by any means necessary.
Alan Minsky here, I want to ask a question actually going back before the details in Sweden to the grand jury in the United States. They are looking for Manning to basically cry uncle, as it were, and give them evidence against Assange. I'm a little curious about that. I mean, doesn't WikiLeaks exist so that people who are whistleblowers can, send in state evidence? And so what further conspiracy are they looking for from Assange, that he held Manning's hand through the process or something? Or
I don't think we know that. Suffice to say that the subpoenas are being issued. There's a guy named David House in Boston who has one. There's several mentioned in my article. And I know how prosecutors work. I've been on the receiving end of a conspiracy charge, and they collect a little nugget here, a little tidbit there, a little piece there. They twist some arms. They pressure people. They tell you what will happen to you if you don't cooperate. So my conjecture is that they're trying to assemble a case against Assange as an example, using Manning, if possible, as an unindicted co-conspirator in exchange for his testimony. Whether he has anything to say, who knows? Because as Assange just said, the purpose of WikiLeaks is to not know the sources because that's the best protection of a source. So it has to do with what is on various emails, not all of which have been disclosed to us. And there may be something there, there may not. I know this, that according to Mr. Weinglass, my late friend, the prosecution is trying to avoid a debacle like the Pentagon Papers. I was a witness in the Ellsberg-Russo case. The debacle was indicting the New York Times. So this may be something like a conspiracy to violate legal protections for computer owners and that sort of thing, to just not make it a freedom of the press issue, as if the press will therefore shrug it off. I mean, this is a freedom of the press issue, and with enough scrutiny and pressure, it could be that the grand jury will come up with nothing that they feel comfortable bringing to trial. I don't know. Then there's the case of Manning, who faces life, who's been horribly abused at Quantico. He may be in better conditions at Fort Leavenworth. We don't know. He's now been transferred from the Marines to the Army. And he deserves to be heard. If you contact my office or you look at the book WikiLeaks by David Lee, and you just read the emails that have been released, written by Bradley Manning, they are one of the most eloquent statements of a generation's plight that I have read since Allen Ginsberg's Howl.
Do you know where's the best place to find those?
Go online, get the book. It's called WikiLeaks by Lee, L-E-I-G-H. He's an editor of The Guardian in London.
Right.
And they're also posted on my website. If you go to tomhayden.com, and click WikiLeaks and look for Bradley Manning, excerpts of Bradley Manning's emails.
Okay, great.
And isn't this bringing up, though, one of the issues that some people have talked about with the complexity of dealing with Julian Assange, where you have Bradley Manning, who seems to have had this purpose behind his releases, whereas Julian Assange, as many people have criticized him for, has this essential belief that all information should be public everywhere, and it's not as politically interested in the same way that Bradley Manning may have been. And then people say, why are we going to defend this guy who seems to have no regard not only for information but also for people? How do his supporters respond to that?
Well, I don't know Julian Assange. I've watched the television programs about him. I've read everything that he said, and I don't share that view. And I think it would be typical of the left to split Manning from Assange, when in fact the U.S. government doesn't divide them. They think they're a conspiracy, and they want to add more to it. Assange is one of those brilliant revolutionaries. He may be one of the breakthrough revolutionaries of our time in the future, which doesn't mean that he's not human, that he doesn't have faults, or that he may have already reached the highest level of his achievement. And now he's facing martyrdom. So would you say, well, he's done his part, thank you. I don't share the view that he's non-political. He is thoroughly political, kind of an anarchist libertarian, I think. And he does have a view of the means of information distribution that Marx would have of a factory machine. He wants the liberation of all information. And in his circles, this notion that you referenced about all information should be free, it's a slogan. And it's appealing if you live in a suppressive, secretive society as we do. Now, obviously, not all information should be free, and the question is open as to who's in charge of the information, are they accountable, what's the role of secrecy, if any, in a democratic society, and so on. But in general, we suffer not from too many leaks. Too much secrecy is our problem. So, no, I think the Assange trial will captivate the world, and every effort has to be made at the same time to honor Manning as a different kind of hero and a real martyr at this point, but not separate them.
You started off, this is Alan Minsky here, and Tom Hayden is sitting in for Ian Masters, and I'm joined by Spencer Downing. You started off by talking about young hackers, anarchists around the world, and it certainly seems in the past few months even that some of the more spectacular information drops have actually come from other groups other than WikiLeaks. So it seems like this has inspired people around the world, with Anonymous in particular.
Well, when I was in the legislature in the 1980s, a young man in the family came to me. He lived in Santa Monica. I don't remember his name. He was a teenager, and he had hacked into the ARPA computers, Advanced Research Pentagon institution, and they came down on him. I've never seen anything like it. Like, he was Joseph Stalin or something. Right. He's a 14, 16-year-old guy, and he got off on his skill, his pride as a young man, and it's very much a young man's game, his pride in being able to hack the man and get into the system, right. Which... You know, you have to honor the spirit, but obviously there, you got two choices. One is to try to repress them and squash them everywhere they pop up, or recognize you're keeping too many secrets, not because human lives are at stake, but because bureaucrats love secrecy. I remember Howard Zinn 10, 20 years ago giving a speech that really stuck with me. It was about the Pentagon Papers, and he said, you know, they keep secrets from the American people. I mean, the Vietnamese know what bombs are being dropped on them. The American people don't know. Right. You keep secrets from the people that you're afraid of, that you consider potential enemies. The American people are scaring the American government. You're the potential enemy. It really struck me. That's the core point. And one of the reforms that eventually will have to come out of this is the declassification of tons of secret documents that are just kept secret so as to not embarrass anybody. Where you draw the line? That'll be a KPFA debate for 50 years.
This is Spencer Downing, producer for Background Briefing, with Tom Hayden sitting in for Ian Masters. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back talking further about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks.
Welcome back. This is Tom Hayden subbing for Ian Masters. I'm delighted to be here talking about Julian Assange, Bradley Manning, and the WikiLeaks case with Spencer Downing and Alan Minsky. Did you have an announcement, Spencer, or should we go right back?
I'll announce it at the end of the program.
All right. I want to read the statement that was given to me and the nation last week by the new attorney for Julian Assange, Gareth Pearce, and I'm quoting, "The history of this case is as unfortunate as it is possible to imagine, in which encounters, undoubtedly believed by all parties at the time to be private, became inappropriately the subject of publicity and therefore, in consequence, no doubt the more difficult to resolve. Each of the human beings involved deserves respect and consideration. It is hoped that whatever steps, as are required, to be taken in the future will be taken thoughtfully, with sensitivity, and with such respect." Now, you might say, what the hell does that mean? If you follow the case, there was, unfortunately, a series of statements made by either Julian Assange or his lawyers disparaging the women and the Swedish system of justice. And it'll be denied now, but it's all on the record. It's all in the article that will be in The Nation tomorrow. Nothing original there, just straight out of the court documents. And so the effect of this is that Swedish feminists are concerned, and Swedish public opinion at the attitude towards the women's case and at the attitude towards Swedish justice, which Swedes think is at least comparable to the UK. Now, it's not paradise. This is a country where the CIA has worked with the secret police to render people off to Egypt where they were tortured. This is a country that's led by a center-right government that favors the war in Afghanistan. The people like Michael Moore, who gave $20,000 to Assange's defense fund, are not wrong in thinking that the hand of the intelligence agencies is somehow there. The problem is that would have to be a perfect crime, because there's no evidence for that yet. There will be probably in 20 years. WikiLeaks will probably uncover it. But for now, it makes people feel, hey, he's got something against Sweden. And if he has to go stand trial in Sweden, why is it in his interest to disparage Swedes? That's the dilemma that this lawyer, his new lawyer, is trying to resolve. She thinks he's got a case on extradition, but I think you'll see a new tone where she's trying not to antagonize people in the country to which he may very well be extradited someday soon.
Well, speaking of that relationship with the Swedish justice system and also with Swedish society as a whole, you've pointed out in a few things you've written that there are still some kind of nasty questions that rise up when thinking about this. One of the questions that people seem to always ask is this question about ulterior motives on the part of the women who are in the heart of this case, and that they might be anti-Assange, anti-WikiLeaks, and so forth. What would you say to that?
You may know me as Tom Hayden, whatever image you have of me, but I am first and foremost a journalist who is obsessed with not being fooled. I try to get at the truth. I try to find out what is going on here. I am not a propagandist. I looked. I talked to the lawyer for the women extensively, and it all seemed very explainable to me as a collision of sexual appetites and nothing more. That Anna Arden is a member of the Christian Social Democrats doesn't mean anything to me. That she was running for office doesn't mean anything. That she didn't know the other woman. I was told by one of my sources that Julian Assange has ascended to this rock star status, which we know is really problematic. It creates sexual attractions and vibrations wherever one goes. And he's single, they're single, it happened. And when it gets down to the details, I'd be glad to answer more questions. But I think it's best summed up by what Anna Arden said in the only interview, not like she's seeking publicity, the only interview given after these events last August. She said this, and I'm quoting, "The charges are not orchestrated by the Pentagon or anyone else. The responsibility for what happened to me and the other girl lies with a man who has a warped attitude to women and a problem with taking no for an answer. He's not violent, and I do not feel threatened by him." The lawyer for the two women, who's also accused of being a radical feminist, whatever that is, I asked him, well, at the end of the day, do you want Assange to be extradited from Sweden to the United States if he comes here? And he said, no, I would hope not. And then he said, I don't think the women do either. But you can't print that.
Now, to clarify again, the two separate cases connecting them, the only manner in which the Swedish case would actually contribute to his extradition to the United States is that if he was in jail cell in Sweden, you would know where he is the day you wanted to find him and extradite him, because it really has no relationship to his extradition to the United States, the case in Sweden.
No, the case in Sweden is a sexual assault case that ordinarily would not put a person in prison. It has the effect of, number one, discrediting his global reputation.
Right.
Profoundly.
I understand all of that.
And number two, it puts him on Swedish soil as if that's better territory to try to snatch him. But when I talked to David Lee, the editor of The Guardian, he said it works both ways. I mean, the United Kingdom cooperates with the CIA. We have tortured people. He's no safer in London than he is in Stockholm. So I don't know what the perceived difference is. He's in trouble either way. But if I were advising him, I would say, let's lift the reputational problem from your back and treat the women's case with the respect that it deserves, and then put the issue of WikiLeaks and the U.S. Justice Department grand jury in perspective.
You probably heard the little bit of the Amy Goodman interview with Julian Assange where your article was brought up, and he was initially a little defensive. But not as much as I thought he was going to be after his sort of initial volley of defensiveness.
Yeah, I didn't think he was ready for it. Amy was briefed.
But it does strike me that he wasn't thinking very clearly as this all was happening a few months ago. Do you think that the change in lawyers signifies, even in spite of his maybe defensiveness in his response to Amy, that he realizes he was tacking that he was taking was harming him?
Maybe. He's a very proud individual, and he's a very, very smart individual.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Do we know anybody like this? They don't back down or change their minds very easily.
But he has changed his legal team.
Well, he got rid of the lawyers.
Right.
And not because they were high-priced, although they are high-priced Fleet Street lawyers, according to my sources. He took on a lawyer who, by her whole tone, is utterly different, while still being a first-class human rights lawyer. So I expect changes to occur rapidly, but they might come in small drops. I watched that interview closely, and I felt like, you know, Amy did the job that you guys do, on the live media. She she dropped it on him, and he wasn't ready to answer. But I could tell he was struggling with the new answer. You know, no one's criticized the integrity of the women. Mm-hmm. And then he went back into these differences between Swedish law, and almost sounding like he didn't want to go to a country where he didn't speak the language. It was a muddled but highly prepared answer. And let's wait and see what happens on the 12th and 13th. You know, he's already been ordered to be extradited.
Right.
People
right.
forget this in right. February. And I read all the legal documents, 500 pages, and it took the judge about an hour to render a decision. So who knows? On the 12th, he goes to the high court. If he's rejected, he can go to the Supreme Court. If he's rejected, he's got an interesting case before the European court commission, Court of on Human Rights, and that's where Gareth Pierce is brilliant. I think it becomes very difficult for the European Court to approve an extradition to America if he's going to be, the phrasing is something like, mistreated in the course of his trial, as in violations of due process, destruction of his reputation, et cetera, things that are much less than coercion or torture.
And one final question is, we're almost running out of time here. Clearly, the momentum that WikiLeaks had going back to the end of last year seems to have been slowed down somewhat. Now, it might just be that they did some very high-profile dumps from the diplomatic cables. Other things are just coming out that aren't as sexy. But the do you have a sense that their momentum has been stalled? I mean, they talked about a Bank of America piece, other things about, you know, stuff in the Cayman Islands, but we haven't heard details on those yet.
I wouldn't predict. In the course of social movements, there's an early period where the revolution seems to be at hand, and great things are happening. And the first phase of WikiLeaks was like that, and it's now over. Like, you know, the Egyptian revolution in the first 20 days. Now it's in a different phase. So I think that it's in a different phase, but that also means WikiLeaks has been so embedded in mainstream journalism that it's really hard to extract. And certainly, you can't get rid of the WikiLeaks effect by demonizing Assange or holding Bradley Manning.
And in the where you started with the movement of hackers and activists around the world, I believe in the last 24 hours, Fox News got hacked. So
there you go. And the hackers are wearing suits and ties, I noticed. They're becoming more presentable.
In the last minute then, Tom Hayden, who's been sitting in for Ian Masters today, remind us, what's the big picture here? Why should people actually care about this? Why should we be involved in this? This is a guy who is one individual who's stuck in the UK, might be extradited to Sweden, and God forbid gets extradited out of there. But what's the big picture here?
Well, I think the United States and the powers that be in every country want to make an example of Julian Assange and squash him in the false and vain hope that that'll stop more disclosure of embarrassing or classified information. So he's a symbol, and he's a symbol to organize around, to educate people around. People will be glued to the media if this trial goes forward. And it's up to local activists, whether they're in Haiti or in Los Angeles or North Africa, to make use of the WikiLeaks documents. Professors ought to be teaching WikiLeaks classes. We're moving into a period of declassification of the secret state, and this is the symbolic trial for that period. I have spent every waking moment since virtually since 9/11 on Afghanistan and Iraq, and WikiLeaks has released more vital information to me about secret armies, about outsourcing torture. We have to remember what they have accomplished and put in the public domain of democracy.
Thanks very much, Tom Hayden. This is producer Spencer Downing, producer for Background Briefing. Tom Hayden and Alan Minsky and I have been sitting in for Ian Masters. Tom Hayden was one of the organizers of Students for a Democratic Society. He drafted the Port Huron Statement, which asked Americans to reconsider what the nation should be about and its role in the world. Ever since then, he's been working to make America a more fair, more just, and more honest broker and actor in the world. And as part of that, he's been working actively to end the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere. The first guest we had today, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, has been working for the same. She was the only person in Congress to vote against the authorization of military force in Afghanistan and later in Iraq, and she has maintained that position ever since. We were talking about her strategies for getting not just people who are on the side of pacifism, but also Democrats who had supported the war and even some Republicans to come up with legislative strategies for getting the United States out of Afghanistan. Among the things she talked about was the need to cut funding. That's one of the things that Congress actually does have the power to do, although there have been runarounds that allow the executive to declare de facto war or to engage in war acts. And as recently the Obama administration said, that War Powers Act does not apply to the actions in Libya. Congresswoman Lee pointed out that Congress does have the ability to grab the purse strings. What the Congresswoman is calling on people to do is to push their legislative leaders to get them to understand that the United States needs to be out of Afghanistan and that they should join this move to bring the troops home. There has been a drawdown, of course, but it is a limited one. And as Tom Hayden pointed out, it's hardly enough. Yet one of the things they suggested is the possible strategy of using this as a first step in getting a larger drawdown of the troops who are in Afghanistan and perhaps working toward an end toward war in Iraq. Hayden also pointed out that there will be a meeting with the administration and also the G8 summit in Chicago and suggested that activists should be there just as activists were at the 68 Democratic Convention to make life difficult for Rahm Emanuel and let people across the world and around the world know exactly what they feel about the actions of the United States and the other major economic powers. Tom Hayden has been working for that kind of activism for some years. Another aspect of that has been the function of WikiLeaks in pointing out the ways in which the United States has gone beyond its own mandates for conducting warfare. And now Julian Assange, as the founder and the force behind WikiLeaks, is under a personal kind of warfare. He is facing charges in Sweden that are complex, to say the least. Some of those charges are charges that would not be prosecutable under U.S. law, for example, his refusal to take an HIV test. And at the same time, there's a distinct worry, at least among his legal team, that an extradition to Sweden might possibly result in an extradition to the United States facing charges of treason or espionage or some other thing like that. As Hayden pointed out, these complexities take some time to ferret out and have become more interesting and more complex as he's changed his own legal team. Underlying all of this is Hayden's belief that Julian Assange represents a kind of hero for our time. Above all, he respects Assange's commitment to keeping information as free and open as possible. As he pointed out in his discussion, one of the things he learned from historian Howard Zinn is that governments keep things secret from the people they fear. And the U.S. government spends most of its energy these days keeping things secret from the American people. Because of this, Julian Assange represents a new kind of heroism. And as Hayden argues, we should all be paying attention to what's happening to him in this legal case. Even more so, should this case turn out to be an extradition to Sweden with perhaps the extradition to the United States, we'll have three countries involved. Perhaps this may be the trial of the century. Again, you've been listening to Background Briefing. I'm Spencer Downing, the producer. Tom Hayden, Alan Minsky, and I sat in for Ian today. Kim Nassiter was our producer, and we also had production help from Wesley Saver. Log on to ianmasters.com to learn more about the program, listen to older programs, and to contact Ian. Click on the contact button to send Ian an email. And we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.